drinking and tearing up and down the roads in their trucks, blasting their music when he knew we had to be up at the crack of dawn to keep the farm going.
That was a while ago now, love, Jerry said, and Barb turned on him.
Are you defending him?
No, God, no, I'm just stating a fact. He's not been able to get up to much like that for a while, has he? You know that.
Fork thought about his strange encounter with Deacon at the pub.
Sounds like he has some sort of dementia.
Barb snorted. Is that what they're calling it? A miserable lifetime of bad deeds catching up with the drunken bastard, if you ask me.
She took a sip of coffee and looked up at Deacon's land. When she spoke again, Fork could hear the regret.
It was Ellie I felt most sorry for. At least we could shut the door on him, but the poor girl had to live with it. I think he did care for her in his own way, but he was so defensive. Remember the upper field, Jerry?
We couldn't prove that was him.
No, but it was. What else could it have been?
Barb turned to Fork.
It was when you kids were about 11, not long after Ellie's mum did a runner. Not that I blame her. The little girl was forlorn, wasn't she, Jerry? She was so thin, she wasn't eating properly, and she had this look in her eyes like it was the end of the world. Eventually, I went up there to tell Mal that she wasn't right and he needed to do something, or she'd be making herself sick with all that worry.
What'd he say?
Well, he showed me the door before I could barely get the words out, as you'd expect. But then a week later, our upper field died. No warning, nothing. We did some tests, and the soil acidity was all wrong.
Jerry sighed. Yeah, it can happen, but...
But it happens a lot easier if your neighbour dumps a round of chemicals on it, Barb said. Cost us thousands that year. We struggled to keep afloat, and it never properly recovered.
Fork remembered that field, and he remembered the tense conversations around the Hadler's dinner table that year. Why does he always get away with it? He asked.
There was no proof it was him, Jerry said again. But,
he held up a hand as Barb went to interrupt. But you know what it's like here, mate. It takes a lot for people to be willing to stand up and rock the boat. It was the same then as it is now. We all needed each other to get by. Mal Deacon did business with a lot of us and we all did business with him. And he collected favours, let the odd payment slide so he had a hold over people. If you fell out with Deacon, it wasn't only him you fell out with. Suddenly doing business and having a peaceful beer in your own town became a hell of a lot harder. Life was already hard enough.
Barb stared at him. The girl was so unhappy she drowned herself, Jerry.
She gathered their empty mugs together with a clash of ceramic.
Stuff the business and the beer. We should all have done more. I'll see you inside. There are 1,000 jobs waiting when you're ready.
She turned and stalked off towards the house, wiping her face with her sleeve as she went.
She's right, Jerry said, watching her go. Whatever happened, Ellie deserved far better.
He turned to Fork, his eyes drained of emotion, like he'd burned through a lifetime's supply in the past few weeks.
Thanks for sticking around. We heard you'd been asking questions about Luke.
Started to.
Can I ask what you think?
Did Luke kill Karen and Billy?
I think, Fork said carefully, there is a possibility he didn't.
Jesus, are you sure?
No, I said possibility.
But you do think someone else might be involved?
Maybe, yes.
Is it connected with what happened with Ellie?
I honestly don't know, Jerry.
But maybe?
Maybe.
A silence.
Christ.
Listen, there's something I should have told you from the start.
Jerry Hadler was hot but not unhappy about it. He tapped a light rhythm on the steering wheel, whistling to himself. The evening sun warmed his forearm through the window as he drove along the empty road. They'd had a solid rainfall that year, and out on the farm these days he liked what he was seeing.
Jerry glanced at the bottle of sparkling wine lying on the passenger seat. He'd popped into town to pick up some supplies and had spontaneously nipped into the bottle shop. He was taking it home to surprise Barb, who he hoped at this moment was making her Friday night lamb casserole. Jerry turned on the radio. It was a song he didn't recognise, but it had a deep jazz beat he liked. He nodded his head in time and pressed his foot to the brake as a crossroad appeared ahead. I knew you and Luke were lying about your alibis for the day Ellie Deacon died. Jerry's voice was now so quiet, Fork had to strain to hear it. The thing is, I think someone else knew it too. Jerry was still 20 metres from the crossroads when the familiar figure flashed across on a bike. His son's head was down and he was pedalling furiously. From that distance, Luke's hair looked slicked back and shiny in the low sunlight. It was a change from his usual floppy style, Jerry noticed vaguely. Didn't really suit him. Luke sped through the crossroads without as much as a glance in either direction. Jerry tutted under his breath. He'd have to have a word with that boy. Fair enough, the roads were usually empty, but that didn't automatically mean it was safe. Behaving like that, Luke would get himself killed. He was coming from the south, from the direction of the river. Nowhere near the fields you boys said you were in. You weren't with him. He didn't have his shotgun. The river's not the only thing to the south, Fork said. There are farms for one, the bike trails for another. Jerry shook his head. Luke hadn't been on any bike trail. He was wearing that grey shirt he loved at the time. You know, that awful shiny button-down one he always saved for best. My impression was that he looked pretty fancy that afternoon, like he was dressed for a date or something. His hair was slicked back. I told myself at the time he was trying a new style. Jerry put his hand over his eyes for a long moment. But I always knew his hair was wet. Luke was well through the crossroads by the time Jerry pulled up. As if to prove a point, Jerry brought his truck to a complete stop and checked both ways. To the right, his son's shadowy figure grew smaller. To the left, he could see only as far as a bend in the road. All clear. Jerry eased his foot onto the accelerator and moved through. As he cleared the crossroads and pulled away, he glanced in his rearview mirror. The image in the reflection was there and gone in less than a second. It had disappeared almost as soon as he saw it, a white ute flashing through the crossroads, from the left, following in the direction of his son. Fork was silent for a long moment. You didn't see who was driving? Fork watched him closely. No, I couldn't tell. I wasn't paying attention and it went by so fast I couldn't see. But whoever it was, I bet they saw Luke. Jerry wouldn't look at Fork. They pulled that girl's body out of the river 3 days later, and it was the worst day of my life. He gave a small, strange laugh. Well, until recently. Her photo was everywhere, do you remember? Fork nodded. It had felt like Ellie's picture had stared blank-eyed and pixelated from newspaper pages for days. Some shops had put it up as a makeshift poster, collecting money for the funeral expenses. For 20 years I've lived in fear of that driver coming out of the woodwork, knocking on the door of the police station and saying they saw Luke that day, Jerry said. Maybe they really didn't see him. Maybe. Jerry looked at his son's farmhouse. Or maybe when they finally decided to knock, it wasn't on the police station door. Chapter 19. Fork sat in his car by the side of the road thinking about what Jerry had said. White utes were 10 a penny in Kiwara, both then and now. It could be nothing. If someone saw Luke coming from the direction of the river that day, Fork thought, why wouldn't they have said so at the time? Who would benefit from keeping the secret for 20 years? One thought nagged at him like an itch. If the driver of the ute had seen Luke, was it not possible Luke had also seen the driver? Perhaps. The idea grew, demanding attention. Perhaps it was the other way around. Maybe it was Luke who had kept someone else's secret. And maybe, for whatever reason, Luke had finally had enough. Fork stared unseeingly at the bleak landscape as he turned the idea back and forth in his mind. Eventually he sighed and pulled out his phone. He heard a rustle of papers down the line when Rako answered. Are you at the station? Fork asked. It was a beautiful Sunday outside. He wondered what Rako's wife would make of that. Yeah, a sigh. Going through some of the Hadler paperwork for all the good it's doing. You? Falk filled him in on what Jerry had said. Right, Rako breathed out. What do you reckon? I don't know. It could be something. Could also be nothing. Will you be there for a bit longer? I'm sorry to say I'll be here for a lot longer. I'll head in. Falk had barely put down his phone when it buzzed again. He opened the text and his frown morphed into a small smile when he saw who it was. Busy? Gretchen had written. Hungry? Having lunch with Lockie in Centenary Park. Falk thought of Rako, flat out trawling through reports at the station and of the coffee churning in his stomach since leaving the Hadler's place. He thought about Gretchen's smile when she'd left him standing under the stars outside the pub. That dress must be all for you, you dickhead. On my way, he texted. Thought for a moment. Can't stay too long, though. It didn't really assuage the guilt. He didn't really care. Centenary Park was the first place Falk had seen in Kiwara that looked like it had had some dollars thrown behind it. The flower beds were new and had been carefully planted with attractive, drought-friendly cacti, giving the park a lushness Falk felt he hadn't seen in weeks. The bench they'd spent so many Saturday nights on was gone, he noticed with a pang of regret. Instead, elaborate play equipment shone in glossy primary colours. It was crawling with children, and every one of the picnic tables bordering the edge was taken. Prams jostled for space with Eskies as parents chatted, breaking off only to alternately berate and feed their offspring. Falk saw Gretchen before she saw him, and he stopped, watching for a moment. She was alone at a table on the fringe, sitting on a picnic bench with her long legs stretched out in front of her and her elbows resting on the tabletop behind. Her fair hair was pulled into a messy bun on top of her head, topped by sunglasses. She was watching the activity on the play equipment with an amused look on her face. Falk felt the warm bloom of familiarity. In the sunlight, in the distance, she could almost have been 16 again. Gretchen must have felt his eyes on her, because she suddenly looked up. She smiled and raised a hand, and he headed over. She greeted him with a kiss on the cheek and an open Tupperware container. Have a sandwich. Lucky you'll never get through them. He selected a ham one, and they sat side by side on the bench. She stretched out her legs again, her thigh warm against his. She had thongs on her feet, and her toenails were a shiny pink. Well, this is absolutely nothing like I remember. It's amazing, Falk said, watching the kids scrambling over the equipment. Where did the money come from for all this? I know. It was a rural charity thing. We got lucky a couple of years ago from some rich do-gooders fund. I shouldn't make fun. It's brilliant, really. Nicest place in town now. And it's always packed. The kids love it, even if I was heartbroken to see our old bench go. She smiled as they watched a toddler bury his friend in the sandpit. But it's great for the little ones. God knows they haven't got much else going for them round here. Falk pictured the peeling paint and lone basketball hoop in the school playground. Makes up for the school, I guess. That was more run down than I remembered. Yeah, another thing you can thank the drought for. Gretchen opened a bottle of water and took a sip. She tilted it towards him the same way she used to offer vodka. Easy intimacy. He took it. There's no community money, she said. Everything this town gets from the government goes towards farming subsidies, so there's nothing left for the kids. But we're lucky to have Scott as the principal over there. At least he actually seems to give a toss. But there's only so much you can do with an empty bank balance. There's no way we can ask the parents for any more. You can't tap the rich do-gooders again? She gave a sad smile. We've tried that, actually. We thought we were in line for a windfall this year. It was a different mob from the playground, though. This was some private group, the Crossley Educational Trust. You ever heard of them? Don't think so. Typical bleeding heart types, but it sounded right up our street. They give cash to struggling rural schools, but apparently there are other schools more rural or struggling than us, if you can believe it. God help them. We made the short list, but no dice this time. We'll look around, try again next year, I suppose, but until then, who knows? Anyway. She broke off to wave at her son, who was standing at the top of a slide trying to get their attention, He slid down as they watched. Lockie's happy there for now, so that's something at least.
She reached for the Tupperware as the little boy ran over. Gretchen held out a sandwich, but her son ignored her, staring instead at Fork.
Hi, mate. Fork held out his hand. I'm Aaron. We met the other day, remember? Your mum and I were friends when we were younger.
Lockie shook his hand and grinned at the novelty of the action.
Did you see me on the slide?
We did, Gretchen said, but the question wasn't aimed at her. Fork nodded.
You were really brave, mate, Fork said. That looks pretty high.
I can do it again. Watch.
Lockie took off. Gretchen watched him go with a funny look on her face. The kid waited until he had Fork's full attention before he went. He ran straight around to do it again. Fork gave him a thumbs up.
Thanks, Gretchen said. He's obsessed with grown men at the moment. I think he's starting to see the other kids with dads and, well, you know.
She shrugged. Didn't meet Fork's eye.
Still, that's what motherhood's about, isn't it? 18 years of crushing guilt.
Is Dad not involved at all? Fork heard the note of curiosity in his own voice. Gretchen heard it as well and smiled knowingly.
No, and it's okay, you can ask. His dad's gone.
No one you knew. Not a local, just a labourer who passed through for a while. I don't know much about him other than he left me with this amazing kid. And yes, I know how that sounds.
Doesn't sound like anything.
Sounds like Lockie's lucky to have you, Fork said. But as he watched the child clamber athletically up the ladder, he found himself wondering what his father had looked like.
Thanks. Doesn't always feel that way. I wonder sometimes if I should make an effort to meet someone. For both of us, try and give Lockie a bit of a family. Let him see what it's like to have a mum who's not stressed and exhausted all the time, whatever that looks like. But I don't know.
She trailed off and Fork was worried she was embarrassed when she flashed him a grin.
It's a bloody shallow dating pool in Kiwara, muddy puddle at best.
Fork laughed. So you never got married at all? He said, and Gretchen shook her head.
Nope, never did.
Me neither. Gretchen's eyes crinkled with amusement.
Yeah, I know.
Fork was never sure how, but women always seemed to know. They looked sideways and smiled at each other. Fork imagined Gretchen and Lockie living by themselves in the vast Kellerman property she'd bought and remembered the eerie isolation of the Hadler's farm. Even Fork, who liked his own space more than most, started to crave company after a few hours with nothing but fields.
You must get lonely on the farm on your own, he said, and could have bitten his tongue off.
Sorry, that was a genuine question, not a terrible pickup line. Gretchen laughed.
I know. With lines like that, you'd fit in better around here than you think.
Her face clouded.
But yeah, it can be an issue. It's not really the lack of company. It's feeling cut off that gets me a bit. I can't get reliable internet and even the phone coverage is patchy. Not that I've got loads of people trying to call me anyway.
She paused, her mouth pressed into a tight line.
You know, I didn't even find out what had happened to Luke until the next morning.
Seriously? Fork was shocked.
Yep, not one person thought to ring me. Not Jerry and Barb, no one. Despite everything we've been through, I guess I...
She gave a tiny shrug.
I wasn't a priority.
On the afternoon it happened, I picked up Lockie from school, went home, had dinner. He went to bed, I watched a DVD.
It was so ordinary and boring, but it was like the last normal evening, you know? Nothing special, but I'd give anything to go back to that.
It wasn't until the next morning at the school gates and I turned up and everyone was talking about it. It felt like they all knew and... A single tear slipped down her nose.
And no one had bothered to call me. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I literally... couldn't believe what I was hearing. I drove past his farm, but wasn't able to get anywhere near. The road was blocked and there were cops everywhere, so I went home. By then it was on the news, of course. No chance of missing it then. I'm so sorry, Gretch, Fork said, putting a hand on her shoulder. If it helps at all, no one called me either. I found out when I saw his face on a news site. Fork could still feel the shock at seeing those familiar features attached to that terrible headline. Gretchen nodded, and her gaze suddenly focused on something over his shoulder. Her expression clouded, and she hastily wiped her eyes.
Christ, watch out. Incoming, she said. Mandy Vaza.
Remember her?
It was Mandy Mantell back then. Jesus, I cannot be bothered with this right now.
Fork turned. The sharp-faced, ginger-haired girl he remembered as Mandy Mantell had morphed into a neat, tiny woman with a shiny red bob. She had a baby strapped to her chest in a complicated sling that looked like it would be made from natural fibres and advertised as organic. Her face was still sharp as she marched across the yellow grass.
She married Tim Vaser. He was a year or two above us, Gretchen whispered as she approached. She's got a couple of kids in the school. Always got her hands full as the self-appointed spokeswoman of the anxious mothers group.
Mandy stopped in front of them. She looked from Fork to the ham sandwich she was holding and back again. Her lip curled in distaste.
Hi, Mandy, he said.
She pointedly ignored him, other than to place a protective hand around the back of her baby's skull, shielding it from his greeting.
Gretchen, sorry to interrupt.
She sounded nothing of the sort.
Could you pop over to our table for a moment? Just a quiet word.
Her eyes flicked smartly to Fork, then away.
Mandy, Gretchen said without enthusiasm, you remember Aaron from the old days? He's with the AFP now.
She emphasised the last words. He and Mandy had kissed once, Fork remembered, at a youth disco from what he could recall. She had surprised him by poking her 14-year-old tongue deep into his mouth, tasting strongly of cheap lemonade as mood lighting glowed against the walls of the school gym and a stereo blared in the corner. He wondered if she remembered. From the way she crinkled her brow and avoided eye contact, he was certain that she did.
Nice to see you again. Fork held out his hand, not because he particularly wanted to shake hers, but because he could tell it would make her uncomfortable.
She stared at it, making a visible effort to resist the automatic polite response. She succeeded and left him hanging in midair. He almost respected her a little bit for that.
Gretchen? Mandy was losing patience. A word.
Gretchen looked her straight in the eyes. She made no attempt to move.
The sooner you say it, Mandy, the sooner I can tell you to mind your own business and we can all get back to our Sundays.
Mandy stiffened. She glanced over her shoulder to where a gang of mothers with similar hairstyles were watching from behind sunglasses.
All right, fine. We don't feel comfortable with your friend being so close to our children.
She looked straight at Fork.
We'd like you to leave.
Noted, Gretchen said.
So he'll leave?
No, Fork and Gretchen said in unison.
Fork actually thought it probably was about time he headed to the station to find Reiko, but he wasn't about to be pushed around by Mandy Bloody Mantell.
Mandy's eyes narrowed. She leaned in.
Listen, she said. At the moment it's me and the mums asking politely, but it can easily be the dads asking not so politely if you'd find that message easier to understand.
Mandy, for God's sake, Gretchen snapped.
He's police. Do you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah, and we also all heard what he did to Ellie Deacon. Around the playground, parents were looking on.
Seriously, Gretchen, you can't really be that desperate, can you? That you'd expose your own son like this? You're a mum now. Start acting like one.
The man who would eventually become Mandy's husband had once written and publicly recited a poem for Gretchen one Valentine's Day, Fork recalled. No wonder the woman was relishing having the upper hand for once.
If you're going to be spending time with this person, Gretchen, Mandy went on, I've half a mind to alert social services, for Lockie's sake.
Hey, Fork said, but Gretchen spoke over him.
Mandy Vaza, she said, her quiet voice like iron. You think you're so all-knowing? Then do something smart for once in your life. Turn around and walk away.
The woman straightened her spine, unwilling to yield ground.
And Mandy, watch yourself. If you do anything that causes my son to lose a single minute of sleep or shed one tear...
Gretchen's icy tone was one Fork hadn't heard before. She didn't finish the sentence, letting it hang in the air. Mandy's eyes widened.
Are you threatening me? That is aggressive language, and I take that as a threat. I can't believe you, after everything this town has been through.
You're the one threatening me. Social services, my ass.
I'm trying to keep Kiwara safe for our kids. Is that too much to ask? Haven't things been bad enough? I know you didn't have much time for Karen, but you could at least show some respect, Gretchen.
That's enough, Mandy, Fork said sharply. For God's sake, shut up and leave us in peace. Mandy pointed at Fork.
No, you leave.
She turned on her heel and stalked away.
I'm phoning my husband.
The words floated across the playground in her wake. Gretchen's cheeks were flushed. As she took a sip of water, Fork saw that her hands were shaking. He reached out to touch her shoulder, then stopped, aware of people watching, not wanting to make it worse. I'm sorry, he said. I shouldn't have met you here.
It's not you, she said. Tensions are high. The heat makes everything worse.
She took a deep breath and gave Fork a wobbly smile.
Plus, Mandy's always been a bitch.
He nodded. That's fair.
And for the record, I didn't not like Karen. We just weren't close. There are loads of mums at school. You can't be friends with all of them.
Obviously. She nodded at Mandy's back. Fork opened his mouth to respond when his phone buzzed. He ignored it.
Gretchen smiled. It's okay. Get it.
With an apologetic grimace, he opened the text. He was on his feet almost before he'd finished reading it. 5 words from Reiko. Jamie Sullivan lied. Come now.
Chapter 20. He's in there. Fork peered through a thick glass panel in the door into the station's sole interview room. Jamie Sullivan sat at the table, staring miserably into a paper cup. The farmer seemed somehow smaller than when they'd been sitting in his living room. Fork had felt guilty leaving Gretchen in the park. He'd wavered as she'd looked him in the eye and said it was fine. He hadn't believed her, so she'd given him a smile and a push towards his car.
Go, it's okay. Give me a call.
He'd gone.
What have you found? Fork asked Reiko. The sergeant told him and Fork nodded, impressed.
It was there in plain view the whole time, Reiko said. It just slipped through the cracks with everything else happening that day.
Yeah, well, it was a busy day, especially for Jamie Sullivan, it seems.
Sullivan's head shot up as they entered. His fingers were clenched around his cup.
Right, Jamie, I want to make it clear to you that you're not under arrest.
But we need to clear up a couple of things we talked about the other day. You remember Federal Agent Fork? We'd like him to sit in on this chat if you're willing for that to happen. Sullivan swallowed. He looked back and forth, not sure what the right answer was.
I suppose. He's working for Jerry and Barb, right?
Unofficially, Reiko said.
Do I need my lawyer?
If you like. There was a silence.
Sullivan's lawyer, if he even had one, probably spent 50 weeks of his year dealing with property disputes and livestock contracts, Fork thought. This could well be fresh territory for him, not to mention the cost per hour. Sullivan seemed to come to the same conclusion.
I'm not under arrest?
No.
All right, Sullivan said. Just bloody ask, I've got to get back.
Good. We visited you 2 days ago, Jamie, Reiko began, to talk to you about the day Luke, Karen and Billy Hadler died.
Yes.
There was a fine sheen of sweat on Sullivan's upper lip.
And during our visit, you told us that after Luke Hadler left your property at about 4:30 p.m., you stayed behind. You said, he checked his notes,
I stayed on the farm, I did some work, I had dinner with Gran.
Sullivan said nothing.
Is there anything you want to say to us about that at this point?
Sullivan swiveled his eyes between Fork and Reiko.
He shook his head. Okay, Rako said, and slid a piece of paper across the desk. Do you know what this is? Sullivan's tongue darted out and ran over his dry lips, twice. It's a CFA report, he said. Yep, you'll see here on the date stamp it's from the same day the Hadlers died. Every time the firefighters are called out, they log one of these. In this case, they were responding to an emergency alert. You can see that here. Rako pointed to typed lines on the paper. And below the address they were called to. Do you recognise the address? Of course. A long pause. It's my farm. According to the summary, Rako picked up the report, the fire crew was called to your farm at 5:47 p.m. They were alerted automatically when your gran activated her panic button. They arrived to find your gran alone in the house with the stove alight. Says here they put it out, calmed her down. Tried to call you, got no answer, but then you arrived back at the house. That was at 6:05 p.m. according to this. I was in the fields. You weren't. I called the guy who wrote the report. He remembers you approaching from the main road. They all stared at each other. Sullivan broke away first, looking down at the table as though an answer might appear. A lone fly circled over their heads with a tinny drone. I was in the fields after Luke left at first, but then I went for a bit of a drive, Sullivan said. Where? Nowhere, really. Just around. Be specific, Fork said. Out to the lookout. Nowhere near the Hadlers' place, though. I wanted some space to think. Fork looked at him. Sullivan tried to meet his gaze. That farm of yours, Fork said. How big is it? Sullivan hesitated, sensing a trap. Couple of 100 acres? Pretty big, then. Big enough. So tell me why a man who spends 12-14 hours a day on a couple of 100 acres of fields needs any more space to think. Sullivan looked away. So you reckon you went for a drive alone? What's your excuse for keeping that quiet? Rako said. Sullivan glanced at the ceiling, considering and rejecting his initial response. Then he held his palms out and looked them both in the eye properly for the first time. I knew how it would sound and I didn't want the hassle. To be honest, I was hoping you wouldn't find out. For the first time, Fork felt like he was hearing the truth. He knew from the file that Sullivan was 25 years old and had moved to Kiwara 10 years earlier with his late father and grandmother, more than a decade after the day Ellie drowned. Still, does the name Ellie Deacon mean anything to you? He asked. As Sullivan glanced up, a look flashed across his face too fast for Fork to read. I know she died years ago. And I know, he nodded at Fork, I know Luke and you were friends with her. That's about it. Luke ever talk about her? Sullivan shook his head. Not to me. He mentioned her once or twice, said that he had a friend and she drowned, but he didn't talk about the past much. Fork thumbed through the files until he found the photo he was looking for and slid it across the table. It was the close-up of the interior of Luke's ute cargo tray, zoomed in tight on the four horizontal marks near his body. Any idea what they are? Fork said, and Sullivan stared at them. Four lines, in two columns of two, on the interior side of the tray about a metre apart. Sullivan didn't touch the photo. His eyes ran over the image as though trying to work something out. Rust? He ventured. He was neither convinced nor convincing. Okay. Fork took the photo back. Look, I didn't kill them. Sullivan's pitch rose. Luke was my mate. He was a good mate to me. Then help us, Rako said. Help Luke. Don't make us waste time looking at you if we should be looking somewhere else. Wet circles had seeped out under the arms of Sullivan's blue shirt. The whiff of body odour drifted across the table. The silence stretched out. Fork gambled. Jamie, her husband doesn't have to know. Sullivan looked up, and for a second there was a ghost of a grin on his face. You think I'm shagging someone's wife?
I think if there's anyone who can confirm where you were, you need to tell us now.
Sullivan went very still. They waited. Then the farmer gave a tiny shake of his head. There's not. Not quite right then, Falk thought. But he also got the feeling he wasn't entirely wrong. What's worse than being fingered for a triple murder? Falk said half an hour later, as they watched Sullivan get into his four-wheel drive and pull away. The interview had gone around in circles until Sullivan had folded his arms. He'd refused to say a word other than insisting he needed to check on his gran or call someone to make arrangements. Yeah, he's scared of something, Braco said. Exactly what is the question? We'll keep tabs on him, Falk said. I'm going to head back to the pub for a while, go through the rest of the Hadler's files. When in doubt, an instructor of Falk's had always said, follow the money. It had been sound advice. Rako lit a cigarette and walked with him to his car, parked on a patch of land behind the station. They rounded the corner and Falk stopped dead. He stood and stared, waiting for his brain to process what his eyes were seeing. Across the doors in the bonnet of his car, the message had been carved over and over into the paintwork. The letters flashed silver in the sun. We will skin you, killer scum. Chapter 21. Gretchen stopped whatever she'd been saying, her mouth frozen mid-word as Falk drove his damaged car into the pub car park. She was talking to Scott Whitlam on the pavement as Lockie played around her feet. In his mirror, Falk could see them staring as he parked.
Bugger, he said under his breath.
It was only a few hundred metres from the police station to the pub, but it had felt like a long journey through the centre of town. He got out of the car, the silver scrapings in the paint winking at him as he slammed the door.
Oh my God, when did that happen?
Gretchen ran up with Lockie in tow. The little boy waved at Falk before turning his wide-eyed attention to the car. He reached out a stubby finger to trace the carved letters, and to Falk's horror, began sounding out the first word before Gretchen hastily pulled him away. She sent him to play on the other side of the car park, and he reluctantly sloped off to poke things down a drain.
"Who's done this?" she said, turning back.
"I don't know," Falk said.
Whitlam gave a low, sympathetic whistle as he walked slowly around the car.
Someone really went to town. What did they use, knife or screwdriver or something?
Yeah, I really don't know.
Bunch of bastards, Whitlam said. This place is worse here than in the city sometimes.
Yeah, okay? Gretchen touched Falk's elbow.
Yeah, Falk said. Better than the car at any rate.
He felt a stab of anger. He'd had that car for more than 6 years. Nothing flash, but it had never caused him any trouble. Didn't deserve to be wrecked by some country moron.
We will skin you.
Falk turned to Whitlam. It's about something from the past. This girl we were friends with.
It's okay, Whitlam gave a nod. I've heard the story.
Gretchen ran a finger over the marks.
Aaron, listen, you need to be careful.
I'll be fine. It's annoying, but...
No, it's worse than that.
Yeah, well, what more are they really going to do? Skin me?
She paused.
I don't know. Look at the Hadlers.
That's a bit different.
You sure?
I mean, you don't really know. Falk looked to Whitlam for support, but the principal gave a shrug.
It's a pressure cooker around here, mate. Little things become big things faster than you expect. You'd know that, though. It wouldn't hurt to be a bit careful, especially with both things coming on the same day.
Falk stared at him.
Both things?
Whitlam shot a glance at Gretchen, who shifted uncomfortably.
I'm sorry, he said. I thought you'd have seen them by now.
What?
Whitlam took a square of paper from his back pocket and handed it to him.
Fork unfolded it. A hot wind rustled the dead leaves around their feet. "Who's seen this?" Neither of them answered. Fork looked up. "Well?"
"Everyone. They're all around town."
The fleece was busy, but Fork could hear McMurdo's Celtic twang rising over the cacophony. He stopped in the doorway behind Whitlam.
"I'm not entering into a debate with you, my friend," McMurdo was saying from behind the bar. "Look around. This is a pub. This is not a democracy."
He was clutching a handful of screwed-up flyers in his large fist. They were the same as the one burning a hole in Fork's pocket, and he had to fight the urge to take it out and look at it again. It was a crude reproduction, probably photocopied 500 times at the town's tiny library. Across the top in bold capitals were the words, "R.I.P. Ellie Deacon, age 16. Below was a photo of Fork's father, aged in his early 40s. Next to it was a hastily taken snap of Fork himself that appeared to have been shot as he left the pub. He was caught in a sideways glance, his face frozen in a momentary grimace. Underneath the photos in smaller type were the words, "These men were questioned about the drowning of Ellie Deacon. More information needed. Protect our town. Keep Kiwara safe." Earlier in the car park, Gretchen had given him a hug.
"Bunch of absolute dickheads," she'd whispered in his ear. "But watch yourself anyway."
She'd scooped up a protesting Lockie and left. Whitlam had ferried Fork towards the pub, waving away his protests.
"They're like sharks in here, mate," Whitlam had said. "They'll pounce at the first sign of blood. Your best move is to sit in there with me and have a cold beer, as is our God-given right as men born under the Southern Cross."
Both now stopped in the entrance. A large purple-faced man, who Fork remembered had once turned his back on Eric Fork in the street, was arguing across the bar with McMurdo. The man stabbed a finger emphatically at the flyers and said something Fork didn't catch, and the barman shook his head.
"I don't know what to suggest, my friend," McMurdo said. "You want to protest about something, you get yourself a pen and paper and write to your MP. But the place to do it is not in here."
He moved to shove the flyers in the bin, and as he did, he caught Fork's eye across the room. He gave a tiny shake of his head. "Let's go," Fork said to Whitlam and backed away from the entrance. "Thanks anyway, but it's not a good idea." "Think you might be right, unfortunately."
"Christ, it's like deliverance around here sometimes," Whitlam said.
"What are you going to do?" "Hole up in my room, I suppose. Go through some papers. Hope it blows over."
"Stuff that. Come and have a drink at mine."
"No, thanks though. It's better if I lie low."
"No, that doesn't sound better at all. Come on, but we'll take my car, eh?"
Whitlam fished out his keys with a grin. "It would do my wife good to meet you. It might help reassure her a bit." His smile dimmed a fraction, then brightened. "And anyway, I've got something to show you." Whitlam texted his wife from the car, and they drove in silence through the town. "You're not worried about me being seen at your house?" Fork said eventually. He thought back to the incident in the park. "The school mums won't be impressed."
"Stuff 'em," Whitlam said, his eyes on the road. "Maybe it'll teach them something. Judge not lest ye be judged by a gang of small-minded nutjobs, or however it goes. So, who do you think's been sending out your fan mail?"
"Mel Deacon, probably, or his nephew Grant." Whitlam frowned. "I think Grant's more likely. Apparently Deacon isn't all there these days. Mentally, I mean. I don't really know. I don't get involved with those two. Don't need the hassle." "You might be right." Fork stared gloomily out of the window. He thought of his car, the silver words scratched into the paintwork. "But neither of them are above getting their hands dirty." Whitlam looked at him, weighing up Fork's response. Then he shrugged. He'd turned off the main street and was navigating the Warren that was the closest thing Kiwara had to a suburban estate. The houses seemed tight and manicured after the sprawling farmhouses, and some of the lawns were actually green. No easier way to advertise you use fake turf, Fork thought. Whitlam pulled up on a paved courtyard outside a smart family home.
"Nice place," Fork said.
Whitlam made a face. Suburbia in the countryside, worst of both worlds. Half the neighbouring places are empty, which is a pain. Security risk, you know. We get a lot of kids messing around. But everyone in farming lives on their land and there's not much in town to attract anyone else. He shrugged. Still, it's only rented, so we'll see. He led Fork through into a cool, shining kitchen where his wife was making coffee with a rich, deep aroma on a complicated machine. Sandra Whitlam was a slender, pale-skinned woman with large green eyes that gave the impression that she was permanently startled. Whitlam introduced them, and she shook Fork's hand with a vague air of suspicion but pointed him towards a comfortable kitchen chair. "Beer, mate?" Whitlam called to him as he opened the fridge. Sandra, who was in the process of placing three china cups on the counter, paused. "Didn't you just come home from the pub?" Her voice was light, but she didn't turn to look at her husband as she spoke. "Yeah, well, we didn't quite get inside in the end," Whitlam said with a wink at Fork. Sandra pressed her lips into a thin line. "Coffee's fine, thanks, Sandra," Fork said. "Smells good." She gave him a tight smile and Whitlam shrugged and closed the fridge. She poured them each a cup and padded around the kitchen in silence, placing various cheese and cracker combinations on a plate. Fork sipped his coffee and glanced down at a framed family photo propped up near his elbow. It showed the couple with a small, sandy-haired girl. "Your daughter?" he said to fill the quiet. "Danielle." Whitlam picked up the frame. "She'll be round here somewhere." He glanced at his wife, who had paused mid-action at the sink when she'd heard the little girl's name. "She's watching TV in the back room," Sandra said. "She okay?" Sandra just shrugged, and Whitlam turned back to Fork. "Danielle's quite confused, to be honest," he said. "I told you she was friends with Billy Hadler, but she doesn't really understand what's happened." "Thank goodness," Sandra said, folding the tea towel in her hands into a tight, angry square. "I hope she never has to understand something as horrific as that. Every time I think about it, it makes me feel sick. What that bastard did to his own wife and child, hell's too good for him." She reached over to the counter and cut a thin slice of cheese, forcing the knife hard through the block until it struck the board below with a sharp knock. Whitlam cleared his throat lightly. "Aaron used to live here in town. He was friends with Luke Hadler when they were younger." "Well, maybe he was different back then." Sandra was unabashed. She raised her eyebrows at Fork. "So you grew up here in Kiwara? Must have felt like a long few years." "It had its moments. You're not enjoying it then?" Sandra gave a tight laugh. "It hasn't exactly been the fresh start we were expecting," she said, her voice clipped. "For Danielle, or any of us." "No, well, I'm not the best person to defend this place to you," Fork said. "But you know what happened to the Hadlers was a once-in-a-lifetime incident, if that." "That may be so," Sandra said, "but it's the attitude around here that I can't understand. I hear some people almost sympathising with Luke Hadler, saying how hard he must have been finding things, and I want to shake them. I mean, how stupid can you be? Never mind what Luke was going through. Who cares? Can you imagine what Billy and Karen's last moments were like? But there's this, I don't know, parochial pity for him. And," she pointed a manicured finger at Fork, "I don't care if he took his own life as well. Killing your wife and child is the ultimate domestic abuse. Nothing more, nothing less." For a long moment, the only sound in the kitchen was the coffee maker steaming away on the pristine counter. "It's okay, love, you're not the only person who feels that way," Whitlam said. He reached across the kitchen counter and put his hand over his wife's. She was blinking rapidly, her mascara smudging around the edges. She left her hand there for a moment before slipping it away to reach for a tissue. Whitlam turned to Fork. "It's been terrible for all of us. Losing a student, Danielle losing a little buddy. Sandra feels for Karen, obviously." Sandra made a small noise in her throat. "You said Billy was supposed to come over to play the afternoon he died," Fork said, remembering the conversation at the school. "Yes." Sandra blew her nose and busied herself pouring more coffee while she almost visibly pulled herself together. "We used to have him over quite a lot, and vice versa.
Danielle would go to their place as well. They got on like a house on fire. It was quite sweet, really. She really misses him. She can't understand that he's not coming back.
So this was a regular arrangement?
Forecast. Not regular, but certainly not unusual, Sandra said. I hadn't organised anything with Karen for that week, but then Danielle found this junior badminton set we got her for her last birthday. She and Billy were terrible at it, but they used to love messing about with it. She hadn't used it for a while, but suddenly got completely fixated on it. You know how children are. And wanted Billy to come over as soon as possible to play with it.
So when did you speak to Karen to set something up?
Fork asked. I think it was the day before, wasn't it?
Sandra looked at her husband, who shrugged.
Well, I think it was. Because remember, Danielle was pestering you to put the badminton net up in the garden. Anyway, I called Karen that night and asked if Billy wanted to come home with Danielle the next day. She said yes, okay, and that was it.
How did she sound?
Sandra frowned as though taking a test.
Fine, I thought, she said. It's difficult to remember. Maybe a bit distracted.
It was only a short conversation, though, and it was late-ish, so we didn't chat. I offered, she accepted, and that was that.
Until?
Until I got a call from her the next day, just after lunchtime.
Sandra Whitlam speaking. Sandra, hi, it's Karen here. Oh, hi, how are you going?
There was a brief pause, followed by a tiny noise, perhaps a laugh down the line.
Good question. Look, Sandra, I'm so sorry to do this to you, but Billy can't come over this afternoon after all.
Oh, that's a shame, Sandra said, suppressing a groan. Now she or Scott or possibly both would be on call for at least a couple of rounds of junior badminton that evening. She mentally drew up a list of potential last-minute stand-ins.
Is everything okay?
She asked, a fraction late.
Yes, it's just...
The line went quiet, and for a moment Sandra thought they'd been cut off. He's been a bit under the weather lately. I think it's better if he comes straight home today. I'm sorry, I hope Danielle won't be too disappointed.
Sandra felt a stab of guilt.
No, honestly, don't be silly. It can't be helped if he's not 100%. Probably wise, especially with what Danielle's got in mind. We can rearrange.
Another silence. Sandra glanced at the clock on the wall. Below, her to-do list fluttered against the corkboard.
Yes, Karen said finally. Yes, maybe.
Sandra had farewell pleasantries on the tip of her tongue when she heard Karen sigh down the line. She hesitated. Show me a mother of school-aged children who didn't sigh on a daily basis, and she'd show you a woman with a nanny. Still, curiosity got the better of her.
Karen, is everything all right?
There was a silence.
Yes.
A long pause.
Is everything all right with you?
Sandra Whitlam rolled her eyes and glanced again at the clock. If she left for town right now, she could be back in time to put the washing out and ring around to find a replacement for Billy before the school run.
Fine, Karen. Thanks for letting me know about Billy. I hope he's on the mend soon. Speak later.
I feel guilty every single day about that phone call, Sandra said, refilling the coffee cups yet again, like a nervous tick. The way I rushed off the phone like that, perhaps she needed someone to talk to, and I just...
She teared up before she could finish her sentence. You weren't to blame, love. How could you know what was going to happen?
Whitlam stood and put his arms around his wife.
Sandra stood a little stiffly and glanced in embarrassment at Fork as she wiped her eyes with a tissue.
I'm sorry, she said. It's just that she was such a nice person. She was one of the people who made it bearable to be here. Everyone loved her, all the school mums, probably some of the school dads.
She started to give a little laugh that she cut dead in her throat.
Oh, God, no, I didn't mean Karen would never. I just meant she was popular.
Fork nodded. It's okay, I understand. She was obviously well-liked.
Yes, exactly.
There was a silence. Fork drained his coffee and stood up. It's probably time I made a move anyway. Leave you in peace.
Whitlam swallowed the last mouthful of his own coffee.
Hang on, mate, I'll take you back in a minute, but I've got something to show you first. You'll like it. Come and see.
Fork said goodbye to a still teary Sandra
and followed Whitlam through to a cosy home office. He could hear the muffled sound of a cartoon playing from somewhere down the hall. The office had a far more masculine feel than what he'd seen of the rest of the house, with furniture that was battered but well-loved. Along the walls ran floor-to-ceiling bookshelves crammed with sports books. "You've got half a library in here," Fawkes said, scanning the contents of the shelves, which ranged from cricket to harness racing, biographies to almanacs. "You're obviously a fan." Whitlam bowed his head in mock disgrace. "My post-grad was in modern history, but to be honest, all my research focused on sports history. Racing, boxing, origins of match-fixing, etc. So all the fun stuff. But I like to think I still know my way around your standard dusty and faded document." Fawkes smiled. "I have to admit I hadn't pegged you as the dusty document type," he said. "A common mistake, but I can mine those archives with the best of them. Speaking of which..." He pulled a large envelope out of the desk drawer and handed it to Fawkes. "I thought you might find this interesting." Fawkes opened it and pulled out a photocopy of a black-and-white team photo. Young men from Kiwara's 1948 First 11 cricket side had donned their best whites and lined up for the camera. Their tiny faces were washed out and fuzzy, but sure enough there, seated middle of the first row, Fawkes saw a familiar face. His grandfather. Fawkes felt a lift in his chest as he saw the name typed neatly in the team list below. "Captain. Fawkes. J." "This is fantastic. Where did you find it?" "Library. Thanks to my tightly honed archiving skills," Whitlam grinned. "I've been doing a bit of research on Kiwara's sporting history, for my own interest really, and I came across that. Thought you'd like it." "It's great. Thank you." "Keep it. It's only a copy. I can show you where to find the original one day if you want. There'd probably be other photos from around the same time. He might be in more of them." "Thanks, Scott. Really. Oh, what a great find." Whitlam leaned against the desk. He pulled one of the crumpled anti-fork flyers out of his back pocket and screwed it up. He chucked it at the bin. It went straight in. "I'm sorry about Sandra," Whitlam said. "She wasn't finding it easy to adjust to life here anyway. The idea of a relaxing country escape hasn't quite worked out like either of us thought. And this terrible business with the Hadlers has made everything worse. We thought we were moving here to get away from anything like that. Feels like a frying pan fire scenario." "What happened to the Hadlers is so rare, though," Fawkes said. "I know, but..." Whitlam glanced at the door. The hallway outside was empty. He lowered his voice. "She's hypersensitive to any kind of violence. Keep it to yourself, but I was mugged back in Melbourne and it ended, well, badly." He looked again at the door, but having started, seemed to need to unburden himself. "I'd been at a mate's 40th in Footscray and took a shortcut through a laneway to the station, you know, like everyone does. But this time these four blokes were there. Still kids, really, but they had knives. They blocked the way, and me and this other man, I didn't know him, just some other poor sod taking a shortcut, we were stuck. They did the whole routine, demanded wallets and phones, but somewhere it went wrong. I got spooked, lashed out. I was beaten up, kicked, fractured ribs, the works. But the other guy took a knife to the guts, bled out, all over the asphalt." Whitlam swallowed. "I had to leave him there to go and find help, because the bastards had stolen my mobile. By the time I got back, the ambulance had arrived, but it was too late. Paramedics said he was already dead." Whitlam looked down and fiddled with a paperclip for a long moment. He shook his head as though to clear the thought. "Anyway, so there was that, and then this. So you see why Sandra's not happy." He gave a weak smile. "But you could probably say the same about almost anyone in town right now." Fawkes tried to think of a single exception. He couldn't. Chapter 22. Back in his room, Fawkes stood at the window and stared down at the empty main street below. Whitlam had driven him back to the pub and given him a friendly wave in full view of passers-by. Fawkes had watched him go, then walked around to the car park to check if his paintwork looked as bad as he remembered. It was worse. The word scratched into the car had shone in the fading light, and for good measure someone had shoved a handful of the forked flyers under the windshield wiper. He'd slipped up the pub stairs unnoticed and spent the rest of the evening lying on his bed and going through the last of the Hadler's files. His eyes were stinging. It was late, but he could still feel his nerves tingling from Sandra Whitlam's bottomless cup of coffee. Outside his window, he watched a lone car cruise by with its lights on, and a possum the size of a small cat scuttle along a power line, her baby on her back. Then the street was quiet again. Country quiet. That's partly what took city natives like the Whitlams by surprise, Falk thought. The quiet. He could understand them seeking out the idyllic country lifestyle. A lot of people did. The idea had an enticing, wholesome glow when it was weighed up from the back of a traffic jam or while crammed into a gardenless apartment. They all had the same visions of breathing fresh, clean air and knowing their neighbours. The kids would eat homegrown veggies and learn the value of an honest day's work. On arrival, as the empty moving truck disappeared from sight, they gazed around and were always taken aback by the crushing vastness of the open land. The space was the thing that hit them first. There was so much of it. There was enough to drown in. To look out and see not another soul between you and the horizon could be a strange and disturbing sight. Soon, they discovered that the veggies didn't grow as willingly as they had in the city window box. That every single green shoot had to be coaxed and prized from the reluctant soil, and the neighbours were too busy doing the same on an industrial scale to muster much cheer in their greetings. There was no daily bumper-to-bumper commute, but there was also nowhere much to drive to. Falk didn't blame the Whitlams. He'd seen it many times before when he was a kid. Arrivals looked around at the barrenness and the scale and the sheer bloody hardness of the land, and before long their faces all said exactly the same thing. I didn't know it was like this. He turned away, remembering how the rawness of local life had seeped into the kids' paintings at the school. Sad faces and brown landscapes. Billy Hadler's pictures had been happier, Falk thought. He'd seen them dotted around the farmhouse, colourful and stiff with dried paint. Aeroplanes with smiling people in the windows. A lot of variations on cars. At least Billy hadn't been sad like some of the other kids, Falk thought. He almost laughed out loud at the absurdity. Billy was dead, but at least he wasn't sad. Until the end. At the end, he would have been terrified. Falk tried for the 100th time to imagine Luke chasing down his own son. He could conjure up the scene, but it was hazy and wouldn't quite come into focus. Falk thought back to his last meeting with Luke. 5 years ago, on an unmemorable grey day in Melbourne, when the rain was still a nuisance rather than a blessing. By then, Falk had to admit to himself, in a lot of ways he felt he'd barely known Luke at all. Falk spotted Luke immediately across the Federation Square bar. Harried, damp and straight from work, Falk was just another man in a grey suit. Luke, even freshly liberated from a lengthy suppliers' convention, still had an energy that was hard to miss. He leaned now against a pillar with a beer in his hand and an amused smile on his face, surveying the early evening crowd of British backpackers and bored youths dressed head to toe in black. He greeted Falk with a beer and a slap on the shoulder. "Wouldn't trust in Mashira's sheep with a haircut like that," Luke said without lowering his voice. He pointed his drink at a skinny young guy sporting a style that was half-shaved, half-mohawk, and almost certain.